Am I the jabber or the drone this week?
That joke's got to end.
Nope.
It's the last time.
Every time.
The very
last time. Until you tell me if I'm the jabber or the drone, that's my thing.
You'll have to call Richard and ask him, because he was the one who invented this ridiculous podcast name. Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, you are friend of the show, Keith Foster.
Yes.
I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California. And today we're going to be talking about the direct-to-Netflix movie Mascots, the mockumentary. And we're finally going to get to talking about High Rise, the long-awaited Netflix homework.
The White Whale.
Mm-hmm. Do you, it's been long enough. Are you going to remember it well enough?
Yeah. I mean, I watched it a week ago. It wasn't.
Last year.
What?
It wasn't last year.
Yeah. I thought you were saying I watched it a week ago last year, and I was like, yeah, no.
You've actually been cryogenically frozen and nobody told you?
What? It's 2017? Who's the president?
You'll have to go outside tomorrow and find a newspaper stand to find out.
Honestly, if the election went one way, I doubt I would have to go outside to a newspaper stand. I think I'd just go online and I'd know.
Right. If you didn't have restricted internet access for some reason.
Yeah. In this weird hypothetical scenario.
That we just keep getting deeper into. Speaking of weird hypotheticals, how did your UCB improv graduation extravaganza go?
It went well. There were more people there than I expected to be audience-wise for, you know, 1 p.m. on a Saturday.
Was it basically like all the different class members invited their friends and family?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they still charged $5 for the show. So, you know, they're proud enough to present it, and charge people. So, I guess, yeah, I don't know. It was just cool to be, cause it was UCB Franklin. So it was the older of the LA theaters. And it was just cool to be like in the green room, you know, where Amy Poehler, Matt Besser, all of them, have been, you know, like,
right.
You know, it's just,
there was a musty magic in the air.
Yeah. The show itself went pretty well. I think I requit myself well and, yeah, I had some good moments and it was a show. It happened and, it was fun.
Right. I was wondering, like, would it be awkward because like the whole idea of like them trying to sort of force familiarity upon the group within an intensive of like what you everyone kind of knowing each other and their comic sensibilities for like a week.
Yeah.
It would be kind of weird, I would think.
I mean, there is there's definitely an element of unpredictability in your other players, you know,
right?
Whereas like with the comedy project, like some of those people, you know, I play for like, you know, 5 to 6 years with 8 years in some cases. So, I mean, yeah, you get to learn each other a little bit better that way. But I don't know, considering we were a group of strangers, I think it went pretty well. I think the fact that it was an intensive made us a little closer as a class than some of the other classes might have.
Yeah.
Because most classes just meet once a week for 8 weeks. And this felt like, I don't know, it kind of felt like summer camp in a way, because I was doing it almost every day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you take everybody's information? Are you all now, like, best buds or internet hanging out?
Yeah, there's a, you know, there's the obligatory Facebook group. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think everyone is interested in staying connected. I know a bunch of them are going to take the 201 intensive in November. I won't be able to do it again that soon. But so, yeah, I think everyone's kind of trying to stay in touch. And,
That's cool.
one of the guys sent me, just today, actually, sent me a copy of a sketch he wrote to look over. So
you guys aren't going to break off into your new improv group, Turtle Cake?
No. Well, I don't know. I'm trying to set up a show.
You can do bar mitzvahs or what are the Mexican, like, Sweet 16s called?
Quinceañera.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's funny that you mentioned the name Turtle Cake, because I hate improv team names. Like, I hate dumb improv names that don't tell you anything about the show.
That's why I immediately just thought of two words. That's how I did that.
Our 101 teams were, one of the teams was called Frank, and then my team was called Whatever.
Great. That's a good one.
Yeah, he our teacher asked us what our name would be, and I said, Whatever.
Meaning, like, whatever everybody feels comfortable with. And he was like, okay, well, that's it. So no changing that.
Yeah. Pretty much.
All right. I actually had an idea, an old pet topic. We're going to resurrect the pet topic because it's almost Halloween and, you know, we try and think of things that are kind of fun and that sort of way. But
time for the yearly purge. Right. So we're going to talk about our list of laws we would break during the purge.
Right. Yes. You know, we've already talked about our favorite horror movies, I think, at some point. We've already talked about, like, what our favorite Halloween movies are at some point. So I wanted to kind of go a little bit more specific and maybe a little bit more autobiographical. So I thought of, what are the five movies that scared us the most, regardless of genre, over our lifetimes? And you could talk about them chronologically, if you like, but why don't you go ahead and what are your five?
Oh, yeah. Am I doing all five, like, right now? Or
yeah, we might, because
back and forth.
Yeah, because it's not really a countdown in that we're talking about our lives. So I don't see the point in breaking it up. So go ahead and just rattle them off.
All right. Number five. So I don't know if this one counts. I listed them kind of in order of how much they sort of stuck with me.
Okay.
So I don't know if this one counts, but I'm gonna list it anyway. And if it doesn't, I'll figure something else out.
Sure.
But when I was younger and living at home, my parents had the Independent Film Channel, and there was some, like, documentary thing. It was like a behind the scenes. It was more like a special feature than like a real documentary. But for some reason, they were broadcasting it on TV. About the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay.
And at this point, I hadn't seen the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but they were showing scenes from it. And there's the scene where Leatherface comes up out of the basement and hits the guy with the sledgehammer and, like, drags him off.
Iconic first kill, yeah.
Yeah, and they showed that, but since it was like a behind the scenes thing, they kept showing it from like different camera angles, and there was no sound. None. There was no music, there was no sound effect of him getting hit in the head. So it kind of just felt like weird found footage.
Like,
and this was before like the found footage
thing.
Format was such a big device for horror.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it was grotesque. And it was just like, it stuck with me.
And it was more so specifically because of the context that they were showing it as like, oh, look at these alternate takes that we didn't use. So it kind of looked like almost like newsreel footage.
Yeah, it looked like something you'd see on like a security cam or something. Mm. And that kind of plays into the mythos of Texas Chainsaw Massacre anyway, you know, like how they marketed the remake in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. You know, like this true story, even right. though it's not at
not,
all. It's
not just true story, like, but they did that with the 70s one too. Like, they definitely want, like, there's that, like, John Larroquette intro where he reads off, you know.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1970, whatever, four children went missing. So, they tried to make it sound like it was a thing that really happened. And I think, you know, the way Tobe Hooper shot the film, obviously yeah. it was really low budget, but I think he tried to kind of make it a little cinema verite, specifically to give that vibe off.
Yeah, and I mean,
because it doesn't look or feel like a normal everyday exploitation movie, even by those days' standards.
And then when I saw the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when I saw the whole thing,
the real movie,
it kind of took away some of that fear, because it was like, oh yeah, this is just a movie, like this is right. this is fake. So that's why I didn't know if it counted, because it isn't the Texas Chainsaw Massacre itself, but it sort of was.
It counts. I get that. I think a lot of the first times I was ever really scared by movies was just seeing scenes from it or something, or a trailer or whatever.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Like, out of context.
Yeah, when you're just seeing the money shots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Were you going to go?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Number four. The Ring. Again, I saw this, I don't know, whenever it came out. It was like the early 2000s, right?
2001 or two, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I was like a teenager. I think I took a girl on a date to see it. You know, so it was very much like a teenage go to a horror movie thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm not like a horror hound kind of guy. I like some horror movies, but I definitely don't, like, I wouldn't say I like a lot of modern horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think anymore they kind of go too much for jump scares and, I prefer a good story with some creepy stuff to, screaming ghosts or whatever in the
right.
corner of my eye. But when I saw The Ring, man, it, like, fucked me up. It scared the shit out of me. Ever since, again, the kind of Japanese ghost horror movie mm-hmm. doesn't really scare me anymore, because I sort of went through that. I sort of got it all out with The Ring.
Well, that was like the first really big Japanese horror remake that kind of set off a trend for about 2 to 3 years. And then those tropes got cemented so quickly that it all kind of felt like cliche not too long after that. But yeah, the first time you saw that movie without the context of, you know, having never seen any of the Japanese mm-hmm. movies they're based on, having never seen that style performed. Weirdly enough, and nobody really talks about this when they talk about The Ring, I was directed by Gore Verbinski, the guy who did, like, the you know, Mouse Hunt and the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Ah. Well, good for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that one really scared me. I haven't really seen it since, because I just remember it scaring me so much at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I revisited it, it probably wouldn't. I don't know. I don't know if it'd really
hold up,
do much for me now.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it was just kind of the age that I saw. And that's most of these.
Yeah. And like, I think it would be for most people.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. Number three, The Mothman Prophecies.
Interesting.
Again, I saw this back. I think I was in high school, right? It was high school or junior high?
That's another one. Kind of around the same time, I think. Probably around like 99, 2000.
Yeah,
something like
and,
that.
And this one, I mean, it was kind of marketed as a horror film.
Yeah.
But I think it's more of just like a supernatural thriller. Mm-hmm. It's not overtly horror. But there was just the concept of it really freaked my shit out. And specifically, there's a scene where even just like talking about it kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. There's a scene where Richard Gere is in a hotel, and he actually like has this like supernatural communication with the Mothman, but he doesn't know what's going on, and, mm-hmm. and it just really freaked me out. And I think the fact that the Mothman isn't like a monster that, you know, sort of has to resolve this conflict with or whatever, I think that sort of made it worse. Because, you know, the hero could never, it wasn't like a hero could defeat the monster kind of thing, mm-hmm. in like The Ring or even Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where even if they die, that's some sense of closure. This is just this really weird thing that, you know, like that character, when he thinks about, you know, 10 years down the line, he's just going to go, oh, what the fuck? You know, there's like no resolution to the sort of that supernatural connection. And I think that's what bothered me is that the Mothman wasn't a villain. It was just,
yeah, it wasn't necessarily out to kill anybody. It just was creepily telling you when other people were gonna die, and
yeah,
there was nothing you could really do about it, and there was nothing that you couldn't report it. Actually, I think the Mothman Prophecies is an incredibly underrated movie. Like, I've seen that movie a few times since, and it was directed by Mark Pellington, who did a lot of music videos back in the day. He did the most famously, I think, he did Pearl Jam's Jeremy, okay. which is a haunting video in and of itself. And then I think he did Arlington Road as a film before he did Mothman Prophecies. But it's really good. It's really, really well written. Very tight screenplay. It has this kind of mystery sort of element to it, and the way the film ties up at the end is almost perfect. Really convincing performances.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it is really chilling and creepy.
Yeah, it's just sort of haunting. It just sticks with you.
Mm-hmm. That's a good pick.
Number two. These are all just kind of going backwards in time, like younger and younger, the more scared and scarred I was for life. Number two is Gremlins.
Okay.
The original Gremlins, directed by Joe Dante?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this one, again, kind of has a context besides just that it was, you know, like a creepy horror comedy that I was definitely too young to see when I saw it.
Yeah.
Because I saw it in theaters.
No, you didn't.
I did.
It must have been in like a repertory kind of thing or something.
It was at the Real Theater.
Okay. They must have had an old reel of it or something, because that movie came out in like 84, 85.
I don't know. Maybe it was just like a limited engagement for like Christmas or Halloween or something, but
yeah,
I did see it in theaters. And that's part of why it was, I think, so terrifying. It was one of the first movies I saw in theaters. And when we got home from the movie, my mom knew I was obviously scared by it. Like, mm-hmm. it scared me. And it was like when the little monsters, the little gremlins would pop out.
Right.
Like the kitchen scene was just the fucking worst thing in the world.
That's a really terrifying scene. The whole thing, like the, can you see what I see? Like the whole build up to that. That is a horror film moment. That, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They are not playing the full family game with that scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we got home, my mom would hide in the kitchen like we had this sort of like island countertop in this the middle of our kitchen, and she would hide behind it, and I knew she was there. Like I she was obviously hiding to scare me, but I didn't know when she was gonna pop up to scare me. And she would, and it would just freak the it just made it even worse. Right. So like, not only was I scared by this movie, but then the horror followed me home, and my mom took that opportunity to traumatize me for life. Number one is E.T.
I knew you were going to bring this up.
That movie scared the shit out of me as a kid. I don't think E.T. is cute. I don't think he's fun. I think he is a scary little goblin who hides in your closet and pretends to be a stuffed animal. Like, he's not fun. He's not friendly. When we're first introduced to E.T., it's when the kid's taking out the garbage, I think. And all you hear is that demonic, and it is just the scariest thing that I had ever seen. I think my mom also scared me with E.T., but it's not as specific a memory as Gremlins.
Right.
And also, like, I think this is compounded by the fact that I had, I shared a room with my brother, and it had those slatted closet doors that E.T. hides in the closet in the pile of stuffed animals.
Yeah.
And we, like, had a pile of stuffed animals. And, like, I could just imagine him in my closet. And for me, that wasn't a fun, cute thing to have in my closet. It was this shrill alien booger, like, that just, all he does is pop out at you when you're taking out the trash. Like, I would have E.T. flashbacks when I was taking out the garbage well into my teens. Well, when I'm, like, far too old to be scared of that sort of thing, but, like, you know, I'd take out the trash, and then I would kind of hurry up as I would be coming back inside, because I thought there was an E.T. behind me.
An E.T. I was never terrified by E.T., but I do get that, like, there was a, I don't know, maybe it was a moment in time or something in 1982, 83, when that type of thing, like, captured the heart of America that I just wasn't there for. And so by the years later, when I caught it on VHS, we had it, like, recorded. We had all these VHS tapes that were recorded on EP mode instead of LP, so you could fit, like, six or seven movies on them. Okay. And they were always, like, terribly recorded and, like, you know, bleeding into each other and that kind of stuff. But it would cut from whatever I was trying to watch, the DuckTales movie or something, into E.T. at the end. And it was always just a scene where he's like, where I think it's like the beginning of the movie where he's like pulling, like picking out the flower, and you just see his like long spindly hand.
Ugh, yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
And then, like, all those scenes at the end with the quarantine when he's all white and dying.
I know. Like, it is, to me, that movie, I was more scared of E.T. than I was scared of the Xenomorph from Alien. because Alien, A, I saw it when I was much, much older and could appreciate it, you know, as an awesome movie. And B, there's an expectation of being scared. Right. Where in E.T., the expectation is that it's a family movie.
Right.
You know, and so when you get these scares, I think they sort of stick with you a little bit more because you're not prepared for them.
You were hoodwinked.
Yeah.
Bait and switch.
Yeah. God damn you, Steven Spielberg.
Twice in his career, if you count Gremlins, too.
Yeah. He knew how to get me with his little pop-out monsters.
All right. I'll go over mine real quickly. And I'll go in chronological, starting at youngest to oldest. And these are all fairly basic as I'm looking at them, but, you know, the first movie to really freak my shit out was The Wizard of Oz.
Oh,
I saw. Really? I mean, I saw that movie. That might have been like one of the first movies I ever saw, like, period, because they used to show it on TV annually.
Yeah, during Thanksgiving.
Was it? I don't remember, but we would watch it, and I remember the first few times I saw it when I was like four or five or something like that. It like really freaked me out, and I was really scared of Margaret Hamilton as the witch, and like just like that. I still think there's a kind of weird darkness to that movie because you hear about all the things like all the people who almost died and like,
yeah,
you know, like the one actor who played the Tin Man who was like almost asphyxiated from the paint and like Margaret Hamilton being hospitalized because of the fire and mm-hmm. all of this stuff. But then on top of it, like there's, you know, like the whole Dust Bowl era is just kind of melancholy and creepy anyway. And then, yeah, like, I don't know. It's antiqued in a way that, that kind of, even like with all the MGM musical stuff going on in it, it feels kind of like, I don't know, like this relic from another time because it is. But anyway, so I saw the movie when I was too young, probably. I don't know. It is a kid's movie, but it freaked me out, as I think it did a lot of people at a certain time.
Was there anything specifically about it? Was it like the witch?
I think it was a witch. Well, you know, I think people have mentioned this scene before, but it's that one scene that sticks out in my mind is just kind of like, kind of a really horrific scene is when, and another bait and switch is when Dorothy is in the witch's castle and she's crying. And then the witch's, crystal ball, you see Auntie M coming through.
Yeah. And
she's
like,
Dorothy, where are you? Dorothy. And she's like, Auntie M, I'm here. And then the face changes back to the witch. And he's like, no, you're locked up and you're going to die.
Yeah. And the hourglass was like counting down her life at that moment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's effective. Yeah, all right. So that'd be the first one probably. And then, moving up the ladder a couple of years, my sister, who still lived with me at the time, she was like 12, 13 years old, and she was really going through this Winona Ryder phase because okay. It was 1992.
And every teenage girl was going through a Winona Ryder phase.
Exactly. And so she would rent anything that had Winona Ryder in it, including Francis Ford Coppola's remake of Dracula. And she made me watch it with her. And at the time I was, I don't know, 7.
Okay.
And I watched it and, which is weird because we had this like no R-rated movie rule back then. I don't know how she got away with it, but
you just reminded me of one that, if we have time, let me mention it. Cause it is ridiculous.
Okay.
Continue. Okay. Sorry.
So yeah, I watched the movie and, you know, the movie is what it is. I still have a fondness for it because of probably the age I was when I saw it. And also because I think it has some neat production design and stuff like that going on and practical effects. And I've been an apologist for Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. But at the time...
I think it still holds up.
Yeah, for the most part.
Whatever.
Keanu Reeves' accent doesn't hold up, but other than that,
no,
it's okay.
No, but that's any movie Keanu Reeves is in.
But yeah, at the time I had no context for anything, so it was all just like this, you know, extreme violence and gore to me. And there's that scene specifically, I still think it's the creepiest scene in the movie, when Winona Ryder's friend, who I can't remember her name. The pregnant one, where she is seduced by Dracula early on in the movie, and she starts to change, and then they have to kill her, but they didn't realize that she's a vampire, so she comes back and she's in this like really bizarre looking wedding dress, and she's like crystalline white and kind of unnaturally floating down the stairs holding this like redheaded infant, and it's just a creepy scene. It's shot beautifully, but it's also like I was. Way too much of a sensory overload for my 7-year-old brain.
Yeah, and I can get that. That's a freaky movie.
Yeah, I mean, it really kind of fucked me up, like for like you know all of that school year. Although I also loved it, like I couldn't quit talking about it. I think like during that time in school, you're supposed to write stories and stuff to just get used to writing. And I would like write my versions of it. So it is also kind of weirdly instrumental in my like film loving life.
All right.
Moving up a little ways, and this is another watched it with my sister thing. It came on TV, and that is Stephen King's It miniseries.
I remember this scaring you. I mean, I wasn't there when you watched it, but I remember like you had some hangups with this movie.
Yeah, you know, and I watched it on TV with like, you know, this is way after it premiered on television in like 89 or whatever it was. They were just showing on USA or something like that. And I remember watching it, and it feels, we watched the whole thing because it's like a, it was split into like days, but they aired it as one film on TV when we watched it. So it was like a 4-hour thing. And yeah, like it just freaked me the fuck out. And it,
everybody floats down here, Cassidy.
Is that your Tim Curry?
That's my Tim Curry.
He doesn't even do that voice in the movie, but okay.
This is Tim Curry in every movie.
I like Tim Curry. But anyway, yeah, no, it really, really, really freaked me out. And I had like dreams and nightmares about Tim Curry's It for years. It's, you know, specifically dreams of like, or he would be on television because that's how I saw the movie, was on TV. And then I would like unplug the TV, but it would still be showing and that kind of stuff.
You know, it's probably a good thing that this whole creepy clown thing wasn't going on then.
Oh yeah. Could you imagine?
Yeah.
But then, you know, kind of funny as with a lot of these things, I see the movie again years later. I watched it on YouTube, or I tried to watch it on YouTube, and it's unwatchably bad. Like, it's just not a good movie.
It's really boring.
No, Tim Curry's good in it, and he's, you know, chewing it up, and he's having a lot of fun. I've talked about this on the podcast a lot because we've been covering the news about this remake that's happening. But yeah, if there's any horror movie where I'm going to say, please remake it, that's one. Because there's a lot of great ideas in there, but the production budget and the TV movie vibe of it and the early 90s-ness of it, really kind of keeps it from ever working totally. But and then one piece of overlap from both of our lists, The Ring.
Oh, all right.
You had to, like the film itself, like the rules of the film itself, you had to, like, pay it forward, and you made me watch it when it was on DVD after you'd already seen it in theaters. So you've already had this movie haunting your life and freaking you the fuck out, and then you tell me, like, we're renting a movie on, like, a, you know, Hollywood Video or something. Like, oh, it's not that scary. It's kind of creepy, but we don't like it.
I know. I have zero memory of this. No,
those were your exact words. It's like, yeah, it's not that. It's more like a thriller than a horror. I'm like, okay, whatever. So we watched it. And funnily enough, I had seen a movie, one of those like cheap knockoffs that came out right after the movie to try and capitalize on it, called Fear.com. Stephen Dorff.
Yeah.
Stephen Dorff. Same exact story, except for you have Stephen Dorff instead of Naomi Watts.
Oh.
And yes. And it's the internet instead of a videotape. But at the end of Fear.com, it ends at the point where they find the body of the ghost and they release it, and it's a happy ending. And that's how Fear.com ends. And so when I was watching The Ring, I was like, oh, I'd seen this. Like, oh, okay. And now I get where all those references were. And then I was like, oh, man, Fear.com ripped this off. And that was basically my feeling the whole movie. And I was into it. And, like, you know, the atmosphere really pulls you in. And when it reached that same point where Fear.com ends, I was like, oh, okay, well, the movie's over. And then it keeps going. And then there's, you know, that has that, I don't want to give it away, I guess, but it has that, you know,
20-year-old spoilers.
It has that ending that The Ring has, which is not a happy ending, and it's really open-ended kind of thing. And that's what really fucked me up, because it just, like, I guess because I was kind of like lulled into a sense of safety because of having seen the ripoff version of it already, that it really kind of pulled the rug out from under me. And then, yeah, I mean, that movie, like, definitely couldn't sleep very well for like 2 weeks.
That's funny. I can't imagine wanting to rewatch that movie. Like,
you did with me, probably because you thought you were going to die unless you shared it with somebody.
And maybe, I don't know, maybe that was sort of me, like, conquering my fear of it, because, yeah, it maybe I was like, I need to see it again to kind of, you know what I mean? Right, to sort right. of accept that this is a movie and
nothing bad's going to happen or whatever.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, well, it made me physically ill that night, and I think I threw up in your bathroom. The last movie that freaked me out almost as bad, and this is like really recent. Like, I've reviewed this movie on this podcast.
Oh, Jesus.
And that's The Conjuring, the first one that came out, whatever it was, 2013.
Okay.
Again, almost kind of like The Ring, I was sort of lulled into a sense of safety with that movie because it's a Blumhouse production. They do their movies their way. I know all their reference points because they're fairly stock genre haunted house films. So I know it's going to be a little bit of The Ring or a little bit of The Ring. It could be a little bit of Poltergeist. It's probably going to be a lot of bit The Shining, whatever it is, a lot of bit Amityville Horror. So I know where all their movies come from and the bits and pieces they take.
Yeah.
And I knew that as I was watching James Wan's The Conjuring, but I like, and you know, to credit to him, this is why I ended up putting it on my top 10 this year. Despite all that, despite knowing exactly where the movie genealogically comes from, it pierced through my film critic brain and right into just like, you know,
primal terror.
Yeah. Like it just works and it worked on a really visceral level on me and it really freaked me out. And I, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, as I was watching, I was like, oh, this is a good horror film. And then like, and then walking out of the movie being like kind of unsettled, but like, oh, well, that's what a good horror movie should do. I will probably give this a good review. And then it really bothers you the night of.
Yeah.
When you're laying there and you're in your bed and the lights are off and all you can think about is something appearing in above you in your room.
Yep. That I've actually been a little gun shy from horror films. I don't know. I've noticed that I like when I was a kid, I was really sensitive to them. And then, you know, I go through like my teenage years and my 20s and stuff. And that sort of like where your brain tells itself it's indestructible kind of era.
Yeah.
That I was a lot, like that was when I watched most of the horror films and stuff. And now I'm getting a little gun shy again. I've noticed I'm like, okay, like I just kind of want the fun scares. Mm-hmm. Like I just kind of want the amusement park scares at this point. I don't want the 3 a.m, what's that shadow on the wall kind of scares.
Right. And some people really enjoy that and still get a big kick out of it. I just thought at this point, I've seen and done everything. Like, I've seen so many horror films and I know so much about the genre that it would be impossible to not immediately recognize a trope. And to a large extent, that is the case. And I can kind of like, you know, wall myself off with intellectualism, but it you know, if it's done well, it can do that.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of those are still tropes for a reason. So was that your whole list?
That's my whole list.
Okay, so I have to go back to one that you reminded me of, and it's silly. Like it's so silly, I bet you can't even guess.
If you want me to guess, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
No, that actually has some legitimate horror with like Judge Doom at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I have to set up a little bit of context before I even mention it because it's so ludicrous.
All right.
Again, I was pretty sensitive to horror movies as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this, at an age where I didn't, you know, I didn't really understand movies. Like, I didn't know what made a good movie, what made a bad movie.
Sure.
And I didn't see the whole thing. So I didn't have, like, the full context of ridiculousness. But my brother made me watch it, and it really freaked me out, and it is so stupid.
What is it?
Troll 2.
Really? I thought when you saw Troll 2 with us that one night, that was the first time you had ever seen it.
No, that was the first time Ashley had seen it.
Oh.
Yeah, it is so bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's movies about how bad it is. Like, I don't need to tell anyone how bad it is. What I need to explain is how it scared me. And it was, God damn it. It was the fact that they would, like, eat this food and turn into the weird green goo that the trolls would eat. Like, that really scared me. Oh, shit. I just thought of another one. You know what? We shouldn't have gone down this road. I'm just like, this is like a therapy session, just like reliving my childhood irrational traumas. So Troll 2 irrationally scared me. Another honorable mention, The Witches. Disney's The Witches.
Mm-hmm. I just saw an article really online when I was at work. I was on Twitter. Somebody wrote that it was like the perfect level of thrills for a children's movie.
No. I could not even finish it. Like, my mom got it. Like, we rented it. And we started watching it because that's what she thought. It'd be, you know, like a fun Halloween movie, you know, like Hocus Pocus or whatever. Mm-hmm. No, we had to turn it off because I had a fit. Like, I was upset. Like, I was bawling at that movie. I forgot how much that movie scared me. I still, to this day, have not seen it because it upset me so much as a child.
I'm willing to bet you probably could handle it now.
Yeah, probably, but I don't really, I don't know. I don't need to. Like, my memory of the scare is better than rewatching the movie ever will be.
Probably.
Okay, so that's our list, plus a couple of honorable mentions.
Plus a couple of honorable mentions. Let's get into the mascots, our main review of the week. And why don't you describe to me a little bit of what's going on in Mascots? The new film by Christopher Guest.
Yeah, the new mockumentary. It's a mockumentary. I'll just read the log line. It's a look into the world of competitive mascots. So it's a mockumentary from Christopher Guest, based heavily, you know, in improv. Mm-hmm. And it's all about these people that are like sports mascots, like in the big goofy mascot outfits, and it centers around them coming together for a competitive, I was going to say a mascot competition, but that's really redundant.
I mean, yeah, that is what it is. It's in Anaheim.
Yeah. But I was going to say a competitive mascot competition.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Very, very redundant. Yeah. And it's filled with, you know, colorful characters and, you know, quirky, awkward situations.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Mascots? Because, you know, I've actually not seen a lot of Christopher Guest. I've seen This is Spinal Tap, which is technically not one of his movies, although that would certainly, I would think, kicked off his career and a lot of what he would end up doing. Yeah. And I think I saw Best of Show a long ass time ago.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. Like, I'm not as familiar with Christopher Guest as I know I should be, especially being an improviser and a comedian. Like, that's sort of,
yeah, I mean, it's sacrosanct.
A comedy sin. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I was actually kind of surprised by how underwhelmed I was by this movie.
I agree. I kind of just kept like sort of waiting to care. Like it not much really did anything for me in this. Like, and I don't know if the big thing was I just never really believed this world they were trying to like set up.
Right.
Like, I know there's quirky conventions about all sorts of crazy shit, but I just never, like, bought into the stakes of it. Like, I never really felt like it just didn't totally suck me in.
No, I agree. And there's a lot of talent involved, and especially in the cast. You have Parker Posey and Zach Wood, and Chris O'Dowd is in there. And a ton of people who are super funny. Fred Willard, who's in a lot of these Christopher Guest movies.
Mm-hmm. Speaking Jane of Lynch. Underwhelmed, Chris O'Dowd in particular sort of underwhelmed me. Mm-hmm. He's cast as Tommy Zook Zuccarello, the bad boy of competitive mascoting.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a fun setup. Like, that's a fun premise.
Yeah.
But I just never totally believed him. The best gags are when he's in the mascot outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of has sex a lot, and I guess that makes you a bad boy. I don't know. I just didn't.
Right. There was a lot of stuff going on in this movie where the characters are sort of, they have their thing, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Zach Wood and his wife are, like, you know, on the verge of breaking up, and they're using
Sarah Baker.
Yeah. And they're using this mascot duo thing as a way of trying to keep it together, but, you know, they're always on the verge of whatever. That sort of, like, never pays off, really. I don't think they have that much comedic chemistry in the movie, sadly.
Yeah. I don't know. I think this movie kind of suffered from the show don't tell. I felt like they explained a lot of the comedic premises, like the characters and their little awkward confessionals. But then you don't really see a lot of great examples.
Right.
Like you said, with Zach Woods and Sarah Baker, they just never really had a lot of chemistry. They talk about Zach Wood's affair,
mm-hmm.
And that story, like,
goes nowhere.
Has no payoff,
yeah,
at all. Because they said it was with Parker Posey's character, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then there's, like, sort of an awkward situation where they're together at a party, but it never. Yeah, this movie never really clicked for me. There were moments I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm, same here.
I did enjoy the British fellow. Tom Bennett. He sort of felt the most earnest to me, sort of the most believable.
Sort of becomes the unofficial main character. Like, if anybody in the movie has, like, a full arc, it's him.
Yeah.
And... Mm-hmm. There's a little, yeah, he's one of the only characters, I think, in the movie that the movie doesn't actively hate.
Yeah.
And that was my biggest problem with it, is there's this kind of, like, everyone's just being goofy and the movie's sort of too in on the joke. There's a warmth that eventually comes into the film, but it really feels a little too judgmental of its own characters for way too long.
Yeah, like, it's like, a lot of it is, like, these guys are mascots, and that's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's even, like, this sort of weird joke about a furry in the convention.
Right.
Also never pays off.
Yeah, you think, like,
that's the obvious
joke to make with the whole mascot thing, because it's such a cultural whatever. But they don't do anything with that premise at all.
Yeah, you just sort of see this guy in a bunny suit in the background every once in a while, like, being lewd with another mascot or whatever. And again, also, that kind of felt a little too and you know, maybe that's just people will blame, like, PC culture or whatever, mm-hmm. but I just didn't think it was that funny to just say, mascots are weird, but furries are really weird. Like,
right.
And that's sort of how it felt, like, furry is a deviant. And it's like, nah, they're just people that, you know, like to wear furry suits when they have sex. Like how does that bother anybody? You know, like,
well,
like, I just,
like, in you, contrast, even, here's yeah. a real story about furries that I think's actually funny and plays in the way that this movie didn't have the foresight to kind of go with. This actually happened. There was a furry convention. I forget where, somewhere in Canada, I think. And they had flew over a bunch of these Syrian refugees because they had, you know, they were trying, trying to reach, you know, some sort of safety or whatever. And they happened to be sharing the same hotel at the same time this furry convention was going on. And these refugee kids loved them. Like, they were so happy that these furries were these people dressed as animals and these big giant bunny suits and stuff were there. And then they ended up, like, the furries who, like, not vetting them to the orgies or whatever, but they ended up, like, kind of, like, cheering up the refugee kids. That's both tender and heartwarming and also really funny at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Like, and that always sort of, that bugged me in the movie was this, it, like you said, it just sort of felt judgmental of these people's lifestyles. And it's like, yeah, so what? They're a little weird and quirky, but whatever. Like, well, I don't know. And maybe it's just a different time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is 2016. I think in general, the world is trying to be a little more progressive.
Well, I don't even think it's a matter of, I mean, if we're, you know, the furry thing is so whatever, like that's barely played in the movie. I think if it's more so the mascot characters, and I actually
that's what I was referring to, right? Why are we sort of picking on these people?
I wrote in my review, I've actually written my review already, and I wrote in my review that you know, possibly because of our economic times right now, it seems kind of like low-hanging fruit or a little culturally insensitive to make fun of low-earning people who are just trying to get by.
Yeah.
Like, there's something about it that I was just kind of like, why are we trying to make fun of people who think they have a talent at something? And then on top of it, the stuff in the movie that I really do enjoy, the stuff in the movie I think works the best when I was actually kind of into it, was the actual routines.
The routines? Yeah.
Yeah, that's when the movie actually kind of like became a movie to me, because I was like really impressed by just, I guess it's just kind of the cinematic nature of just watching somebody perform.
Yeah.
But that stuff was all great.
I think maybe the movie, like, I know Christopher Guest's style is, you know, the very, like, get the quirky characters and then sort of improvise around a script.
Right, yeah, you sort of know where the scenes are going to go and da-da-da, yeah.
And I think maybe this movie could have benefited from some more scripting stuff, because I do think they found some fun stuff.
Yeah.
I think it just, they didn't totally key in on what I liked as a viewer.
Right.
But yeah, like the routines, I kind of wanted to see more of that throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you kind of see them half rehearsing and stuff, and then, like, you know, one of them's working on a thing and then somebody comes up and talks and they have like an awkward conversation. But yeah, I wanted to see more of these like silly but talented performances.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly, I know we mentioned the British guy. I also did enjoy the plumber and his story, and particularly his routine, I thought was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little twist at the end of it.
Right.
That made me, but yeah, that the same thing with, this bad boy character. Like, we didn't really get a sense of him as a bad boy until his performance.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, little fun things throughout. And maybe that's sort of the point of the movie, is it is this build up to these performances, and
right,
and we, you know, we are making fun of them until we see sort of the art of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the movie quite keyed in on that.
No, because I think because the movie is often kind of going for the lowest hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And I get that, like, when you're improvising a scene and you don't have dialogue set into place, you can, even though most of these movies, I'm sure they improvise every scene about 70 times until they have something to edit with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're not given, like, the dialogue that necessarily always directs the story. And so because of that, I feel like the movie kind of lacks story beats through most of it. Like, there's a lot of characters, but none of them really interact all that much. They're all kind of just doing their own thing. And so I was surprised that by the time what ends up being the climax of the movie, which is this big routine performance before they give out the awards, that that was basically we're heading down to the end of the movie. I was like, wow, we did not get a lot accomplished in this movie, story-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It kind of felt like a 90-minute trailer for a movie.
Yeah, and there were just some gags that just completely fell flat for me, like the fact that the competition was being sponsored by the Gluten-Free Network. That doesn't feel real to me. That just feels like just a kind of a shitty joke.
Yeah, and a tired one at that. Like, I mean, whatever it could have been, they could have come up with something better than that. We get it. Like, people who are whatever into fad diets can be obnoxious, but that I don't know. Yeah, I agree. That was really tiresome.
And that's. I think an example of the movie at its worst, whereas the competition is the movie at its best.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I don't hate it. It's almost too unambitious to hate.
Yeah. My thing was I just kept continually like I kept trying to care.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was nothing for me to really hold on to with any of these characters. I was just like, okay. Like, what's the point of this?
And I could have forgiven a lot of all of that stuff if it had just been funnier. Like, yeah. if you could have made me laugh consistently all the way through. Another movie that kind of takes this style that came out this year that was consistently funny was Popstar.
Yes.
That was a movie that I think kind of took that sort of Christopher Guest-esque Spinal Tappy sort of idea and then actually elevated it into its own thing. Whereas I felt like this movie was just kind of like, haven't we seen this before? Like, isn't this like all kind of been done?
I agree. There wasn't anything that like stood out as like wholly original or funny.
I mean, even Christopher Guest ripoffs like Drop Dead Gorgeous is better than this.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Popstar because that movie is great. And one of my favorite movies of the year so far, actually.
Definitely probably my favorite comedy of the year. And I went in with mostly low expectations because I'm not even an Andy Samberg guy.
I was in the film and working with Andy Samberg was a great experience.
I'm sure.
He's a real professional.
And by working with him, you were an extra in like a scene
I was an extra in some of the concert scenes. But they were the best concert scenes.
I'm sure. Okay, well, that was Mascots. And friend of the show, Denise, from the Listening Party podcast, I'm really sorry. You're probably fuming and really mad at us right now because she has a... She's kind of obsessed with sports mascots, and she was really pumped about this movie. And I think she's trying to get a mascot themed podcast off the ground right now. She's just looking for interviewers.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
No, I think she should totally do it. I think the world of mascotting I think that's sort of the problem with this movie is I feel like there's an interesting story there. And the movie was just so concerned with being idiosyncratic and weird that it didn't care about
remember the to be story. Funny.
Yeah. Like, what is it about that makes them feel, you know, sort of complete? I feel like
I kept thinking throughout the movie that an actual documentary about mascots would be more interesting and entertaining than this movie.
Well, there's that, there was that show on Hulu. I think it's even called Mascots.
Oh.
And it's like a docuseries, and it follows a couple of mascots through like a sports season.
Okay.
I haven't watched it, but it looked interesting. And so even when I saw like the trailer for this movie, I was like, okay, I don't know. I just already felt like it existed.
Yeah, but fair enough. Okay, well, let's go ahead and quickly do our Netflix homework. which is going to be difficult because there's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat indescribable.
If you listen to the podcast last week, when we talked about The Girl on the Train, now you'll understand, now Cassidy, you'll understand my joke about a Luke Evans weird, like, domestic violence double thriller.
Right, yeah. High Rise is directed by Ben Wheatley, which is why I originally assigned it forever ago. He's a up-and-coming British horror director. He did the films Kill List and A Field in England and Sightseers. And he's quickly kind of rising to prominence as a foreign film entity. And it stars Tom Hiddleston in this kind of alternate version of London, where he's like a surgeon, and he lives in this gigantic sort of utopian.
Specifically, he's a brain surgeon.
Yes, he's a brain surgeon who lives in this gigantic utopian high rise that sort of separates everybody by class. The lower you are on the high rise, the lower you are in economic standing.
Importance.
Yeah. And he's about somewhere in the middle, but he's definitely positioned in just a place to kind of see both sides. And, you know, you have Jeremy Irons, who lives on the top as this kind of eccentric, you know, Wizard of Oz type. And Elizabeth Moss is in there. She's having a baby. And Luke Evans is there as well. And his wife is trying to have an affair with Tom Hiddleston. And the movie has this kind of...
Well, no. Luke Evans, his character was married to Elizabeth Moss.
Oh, in the film?
Yeah. The pregnant woman.
I'm mixing up because Tom Hiddleston has sex with like five people in this movie.
Yes. So, you're thinking of Sienna Miller, who, like, when we're first introduced to her and Luke Evans, he talks about how he wants to have an affair with her, but she won't have an affair. But he's married to the pregnant Elizabeth Moss.
Right. And the movie has this kind of loose structure where it's almost kind of like I was describing with Mascots, but I think maybe done with more of a purpose. It's more of this true ensemble kind of thing where everybody sort of has their own story and everybody's sort of existing in their own world within this, you know, this small world within a world. And obviously, the movie's working largely on metaphor.
It sort of starts in a bit more of a realistic place, and then it gets pretty surreal pretty quick.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I thought about a lot of different movies as I was watching this, and you know, a few of them come to mind. I think the work of David Cronenberg is all over this movie.
Specifically Kubrick, like.
Yeah, I think there's especially the kind of 70s kind of look to it kind of reminds me a lot of like some of the stuff from The Shining.
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange, yeah, that plays into, although it's not nearly as anarchistic, but it really has that kind of cold, detached steeliness of the 80s work of Cronenberg. I thought a lot about movies like, which also had Jeremy Irons, but Dead Ringers. As well as Naked Lunch, which is structurally similar, where it kind of has this sort of dreamlike, you know, you go from one thing to another without any kind of connective tissue. And then I also thought a lot about this film that Orson Welles made in the 60s with Anthony Perkins that we covered on the podcast a long time ago called The Trial, which was based on a Kafka novel, because I think, you know, if you're allowed to give me a swirly for saying this, but I would call this film very Kafka-esque, in that it's about a character who's kind of in this this weird state of being the whole time, and he sort of doesn't know his place in it.
I think that was sort of my problem with the movie is I saw more of its influence. More of its influences than I actually saw an original movie. Like, I felt like, to me, it kind of felt like I felt a lot of Kubrick, and it kind of felt like a sort of a Kubrick fan fiction to me. It just seems so wrought with references mm-hmm. and things it was trying to achieve. And I don't know that it was entirely successful with a lot of that.
I would agree with you. I think in a lot of ways, I think the movie's more interesting than good.
Yeah.
And I think Hiddleston is doing some interesting work here. A lot of the performances are really good. I think this is maybe the best I've ever seen Luke Evans.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely playing to his type.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's just the part was, pretty meaty, and gave him a lot of scene to chew.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it with this sort of glowering Wolverine menace.
Right. Yeah. And I like that I love the way the movie looks. I love the production design, the look of the movie. Mm-hmm. I like that it's kind of doesn't have a sense of time or place. It looks like the 70s in the interiors, but then there's stuff that would, and a lot of the cars and that kind of stuff, but then there's stuff about like the structure of this actual high rise that feels almost futuristic. So it exists out of any kind of time or place.
And you get the sense, too, that it's specifically this building. Like,
right.
it feels like everywhere else is the 70s, mm-hmm. but this place is sort of... And I think there is a little bit of, like you said, there's a lot of metaphor, but they're definitely talking about, like, the metaphor of sort of, like, technology... like our dependence on technology
mm-hmm.
and what happens to, society when that thin fabric breaks down. Like there's definitely some interesting thought experiments
right.
in this movie.
And I think there's a ton in here just about the British class system. I think yeah, that's some, sort of...
I read somewhere, or someone I heard describe this movie as Snowpiercer in a building.
Yeah, I thought about that movie a lot. And I think both movies reference a lot of Brazil as well. I mean, we can mm-hmm. go on and on and on about these dystopian whatevers that kind of play around with these ideas.
But that's what I mean when I say this movie in particular felt like... It was never greater than the sum of its parts.
Agreed.
Whereas Snowpiercer, it's referencing a lot of similar stuff, but there's enough like action and enough driving original story to keep me invested. Whereas this, there were definitely times when I was getting a little bored or a little like, what is going on?
Yeah, I struggled with a lot of the personal motivations of the characters. And I get that the movie wants to be detached. It's certainly mm-hmm. keeping us at an arm's length from the motivations of the characters, what they're thinking, what they're feeling from scene to scene, because it sort of wants to play its hand a little close. I mm-hmm. get that. But it also is sort of... I think it's too detached for the type of story that it is.
Yeah.
Because if I don't understand what the character's motivations are from scene to scene, then I don't necessarily have a reason to follow them through scene to scene.
Yeah. I think that's part of why Luke Evans stood out is because he in his character is a lot more primal and simplistic than
and
the
emotional
other characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I always sort of knew where he was at and what he was, what was going on with him. Even though he is this brutish, but charming character.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, about halfway through the movie, it sort of became, his movie to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Hiddleston kind of fades into the background.
Yeah. I mean, he's your basic kind of, cipher. Like he does a really good job at being that, and I think he serves the story exactly the way he was directed to.
Yeah.
But you can't help but not care so much about him in the movie, which is sort of a problem.
Yeah, like, I feel like his character was sort of underwritten.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Wilder, Luke Evans' character, was just so much more interesting. And again, like you said, I think this is definitely the most interesting I've ever seen Luke Evans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mildly recommend the movie just because it's there's there's so much interesting stuff going on in it, whether it, you know, the craft of the filmmaking, you can't really fault too much is on a technical level. The movie is really interesting to look at.
Especially because I don't think, I think they did this with a fairly low budget too, which is even more impressive.
Yeah.
I believed in this weird building world. And I think they've definitely made the budget work for them. But I don't know. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. It's sort of a love letter to all these movies, you know, we've mentioned. But it as a movie itself, I think, lacks a lot and never totally delivers on a lot of the things it promises.
I concur. And I would tell people who have seen or maybe like this movie to go back and watch Orson Welles' The Trial, because I think that's a really interesting movie that deals with a lot of the same kind of narrative ideas as this movie does, and deals with the surrealism in a more interesting way. And David Cronenberg's movie from a couple years ago, which is real similar to this, Cosmopolis, starring Edward Cullen.
Yeah.
Robert Pattinson.
The Hufflepuff kid.
Right. Cronenberg knows how to use his kind of lack of charisma and turn it into style. Okay. Well, that's the show for today. And I think we're going to have you on next week while we're still kind of in co-host limbo. but what did you assign me for next week?
I assigned you the Netflix documentary Finders Keepers. I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about the movie more than
that. Nope, that's all you have to say.
Okay.
And if anybody has anything to say about any of the things we talked about in this episode, you know, the movies that scared you the most as a child, the Netflix film Mascots.
How you feel about furry culture?
Yeah. High Rise or Finders Keepers, you can email me at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. Subscribe to us on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can stream us on player.fm, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can read my movie reviews that I write weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. See some of the content that I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/authors/Cassidy. Be sure to read the content that friend of the show Brad Decker has provided for his website at panelandframe.com. And go ahead and listen to Rod and Denise at their Music Request podcast here in Southern California, The Listening Party. And if the her mascot podcast ever gets off the ground, I know that right now there's a website for it. And there's kind of an introductory page. As soon as she starts getting some actual interviews on there, I'll give you guys the links and everything for that. Patrick, who's going to be on the show here shortly to talk about Doctor Strange, you can listen to his podcast, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. What do you want to promote? Where can people find you online? What's your Twitter handle?
They can follow me at Keith Foster Kid. I'm also on Instagram, which I don't update a lot, but I'm trying to update more. And I feel like, I don't know, whatever. My YouTube show, Tonight in San Diego, that I'm the writer and co-host for, is still on hiatus. We'll be coming back the first week of November. But feel free to go and watch, you know, all of our old videos. Tonight in San Diego, you can go to tonightinsandiego.com. Or if you want to get tickets when we come back in November to see it live, you can go to tonightinsandiego.com or reader tickets or something. I don't know. I don't normally talk about that part of the show. I'm the co-host. I do the sillies. But yeah, Tonight in San Diego, at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter and Instagram.
Cool. Well, that'll be it. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.